At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, what do we got? In market news, Candy Crush is going to go public. The catfish industry wants new regulations and the very big business of romance novels. Yep, romance, candy, and catfish from American Public Media. This is indeed Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 18th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us. There is no love lost, as we all know, between Congress and the White House. The president is frustrated by Republicans in the House and Senate and their reluctance to agree to his policy proposals. So he has, as he said, decided to go it alone, get things done without Congress whenever he can this year. And so the Barack Obama solo world tour continued today in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, a Safeway distribution center there where he directed the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation to increase fuel efficiency standards for heavy-duty vehicles, 18-wheelers, basically. And he said he wants it to happen on a pretty aggressive timetable. So sure, the president can work without Congress to some degree, but can he work without industry? Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
If trucks were more fuel efficient, President Obama says, truckers would buy less gas, the price of goods would go down, and we'd import less oil.
So it's not just a win-win, it's a win-win-win. You got three wins.
The president hasn't said exactly what the new fuel standards would be, but he wants them in place soon, by March 2016. That's about 2 years from now.
The goal we're setting is ambitious. But these are areas where ambition has worked out really well for us so far.
It is a very, very aggressive timeline.
Sandeep Kaur directs commercial vehicle research for Frost & Sullivan. That's a business consulting firm. Kaur says fundamentally this is a good move.
But it's a move that will have short-term pain associated with it, but there will be long-term gain.
And that's because this technology is going to be expensive, at least at first. Manufacturers will have to shoulder the research and development costs, and truckers may have to pay more for it. So far, it doesn't look like those groups are putting up roadblocks. Phil Byrd is the chairman of the American Trucking Association. He and his organization support the president's objectives, greater fuel efficiency, reduced greenhouse gas emissions. But Byrd does have some concerns about the timing.
When we purchase a new truck, we expect lower maintenance cost and higher reliability.
And in the past, he says, new technology hasn't always worked the way it's supposed to, and it's ended up costing the industry.
You can't be hoodwinked. You could save at the pump and lose in delivering the freight.
In his speech, President Obama pointed to how successfully the auto industry has done this. He said it's been able to produce more fuel-efficient vehicles on a short timetable. But Gary Mateer says that comparison is flawed. He's an analyst with IHS. The market for cars is much bigger than the market for heavy trucks.
So you've got a big increase that you got to spread across a very small base.
Every year, more than 13 million cars are sold in the U.S., Mateer says. That's compared to 180,000 trucks. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
King Digital announced it was going to go public today. In case you're not of the smartphone game-playing ilk, King makes the highly popular and highly addictive game Candy Crush. It's kind of like Tetris, but with pieces of animated candy. And it turns out Candy Crush is a pretty sweet product. King Digital brought in more than $500 million last year from Candy Crush, 99 cents at a time. Because here's the thing, Candy Crush itself is free to download. You only pay once you're already playing. We asked recovering Candy Crush-aholic Stacey Vanek-Smith to explain why the pay-to-play freemium model is so lucrative.
I started playing Candy Crush last summer. For a couple months, I advanced from one level to the next until I conquered level 35. Then Candy Crush said I had to pay 99 cents to get to level 36. I held out for 6 weeks, playing level 35 over and over again. And then I cracked.
Everybody pays the dollar. I think that's the point.
Brian Blau is an analyst with Forrester Research.
There's lots of different types of game mechanics that cause similar pain points.
Pain points are things like not being able to get to level 36 or having to wait. You can play Candy Crush 5 times, and then you have to wait a half an hour to play again, unless you pay 99 cents, which I never did. Except a few times.
Impatience is one of the game mechanics that the game developers will jump on.
Using our impatience or addiction to squeeze money out of us is nothing new, says Renee Ritchie, editor-in-chief of iMore.
They employ psychologists the way casinos do. They do a lot of testing to see when users stop playing so they can optimize the game to make it a little bit easier to keep them on the game longer. It's a huge, very similar to casino-style business for them.
And just like casinos, the so-called freemium model is built around whales, people who shell out hundreds of dollars in a weekend on their free game of choice.
I knew a person who went out and bought a new iPad and then spent $100 the first day on Candy Crush because if he couldn't get past the level after 2 or 3 tries, he would just pay to get past it.
Still, Ritchie says, relying on freemium is tricky. Addictive hits like Candy Crush are rare and people get tired of them. Ritchie says game makers need to mix freemium with other models to avoid getting crushed. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
From the Congressional Budget Office today, this little tidbit. You remember President Obama's plan to raise the minimum wage for new federal contract workers to $10.10 an hour? He signed the executive order just the other day, right? Well, the CBO said today that will cost the economy 500,000 jobs by the second half of 2016. Me? I figure the partisan bickering over that starts right about now. On Wall Street today, mezza mezza, come see, come saw, you know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. American catfish farmers are trying to get a little more of their product onto your dinner plate, and they're a little peeved with the U.S. Department of Agriculture about their lack of success. 5 years ago, the USDA got $15 million to set up a new catfish inspection office and come up with standards that would put American catfish at the top of the catfish food chain, if you will. So far, nada on that, leaving catfish farmers like Townsend Kaiser scratching their heads. He runs a catfish farm down in Greensboro, Alabama. We talked to him a couple of times, I think. Mr. Kaiser, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you, Mr. Kai. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. So listen, I have to tell you, it usually when you talk to small business people, they're all about too much regulation and too much government intrusion. But if I read it right, you want more of the government keeping an eye on the catfish industry.
Yes, sir, we do. We want to make sure we're putting out a safe product, and we want to make sure all other products tagging along with us are as safe as we are.
And you want then this inspection office to, in essence, do its job?
Yes, sir. The USDA has a wonderful track record, and I don't know any consumer that is concerned with the USDA. They do a great job with beef, pork, and poultry, and we would love for them to do the same thing with catfish.
You put yourself up there with the other proteins, huh?
Yes, sir. We want to be up with the big boys.
Fair enough. I get that. It's been, what, 5 years since this catfish inspection office was supposed to have opened. They have, I understand, not inspected a single catfish. What gives?
I'm not sure. But it has been a 2008 Farm Bill. It was passed into law, and we have, this is, what, 2014, and it still hasn't happened yet. But we're taking big steps now.
You were out last week at the Catfish Farmers of America conference down in New Orleans. What's the buzz on the street about anything getting done in terms of you guys being able to get inspected?
We're quietly optimistic.
You sound like a politician, quietly optimistic.
Well, we haven't had much luck for the last 5 years, but we are hoping we can all move forward from here.
Who do you sell to? Do you sell restaurants, wholesalers? What do you do?
No, so we sell to a processing plant who then sells them to who fillet them and then sell them to restaurants and wholesalers and retailers.
Can I get catfish on the menu out here in Los Angeles?
Matter of fact, I believe there are some out there. I'm not sure where, but I know Wolfgang Puck has a restaurant in California with
with catfish on it. All right, well, I'll have to check that one out. In the meanwhile, Mr. Kaiser, how's business? Are you guys selling stuff?
It's getting better. Lent's right around the corner, 2 weeks away, and that's always a big time in the fish business, and we're looking forward to hopefully some increased sales due to Lent.
What's your favorite recipe? How do you like your catfish?
Fried. I mean, I like it blackened, but it's hard to beat good, fresh, fried catfish.
Fair enough. Towson Kinzer, he's a catfish farmer out in Greensboro, Alabama. Mr. Kaiser, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I enjoyed it. You have a nice day.
You too. The forecast high for Chicago, Illinois today was 41 degrees. Not so bad for Chicago in the middle of February, right? More to the point, though, it's a long way from the cold, dark days of the polar vortex when local news reports in Chicago were warning that more than a couple of minutes outside could kill you. And on those days, in fact, many of Chicago's commuter trains did die. Engines froze, switches got clogged with snow, and people just waited in the cold and waited some more because the area's commuter rail agency was a bit of an accident waiting to happen. From Chicago Marketplace's Dan Wiseman has that story.
Stacy Castro has been a Daily Metro writer for 4 years, and she's been pretty pleased, until the deep freeze hit in early January. A lot of people stayed home. Castro went to her Metro stop and waited.
It would just fly right by the station, and everybody would go back down to the warming station and hope for another one to come, but you don't really know.
Same thing played out around the region. Metro's CEO says just 30% of the agency's trains ran on time that day. Problems continued through weeks of terrible weather. There were evening rush hours when nothing left for an hour or more on some lines. Joseph Schwederman is a transportation professor at DePaul University and a Daily Metro writer. He compares the crowds that piled up at the stations on those nights to the throngs at Ellis Island. But these huddled masses were angry.
I mean, you look at commuters, they are like creatures of habit. They take this train every morning. They take this train home if they work late. And you start interfering with that schedule, and suddenly they are in your face.
Commuter rail schedules encourage this mentality. The routine is unforgiving. Arrive 10 seconds late for the 6 o'clock train, and you will be waiting for the 6:44. January's service failures turn out to be just the tip of a very scary iceberg for Metra. The iceberg itself, or at least its most potent symbol, sits in a warm, narrow room about 2 miles west of downtown. It's lit by big windows in the middle. They look out at 7 sets of railroad tracks that cross paths here. The machine in this room, the iceberg, is a beautiful metal console, at least 20 feet long, with dozens of switches and blinking lights. Rich Oppenheim oversees the staff here.
What you see in front of you is the A2 interlocking machine. When it was installed here, it was state-of-the-art, really the best thing that money could buy at the time.
That was 1932. The A2 does a huge job for Metra. This is an intersection for trains. During rush hour, there's an average of one every minute or two, and it takes some time for each one to get through. At most, 3 or 4 trains can cross at a time, and A2 is the crossing guard. One operator sits at a desk, talking back and forth with engineers on a radio. The other physically throws switches to allow each train to cross in its turn.
Really, it is amazing when you think about an antique like this performing the function that it does.
But it can't operate forever. Not only is it sensitive to bad weather, but parts are getting hard to come by. According to a study by the agency that oversees Metra, replacing the A2 is just one item on a $9.7 billion to-do list. Metra officials say they expect to see about $2 billion. It's not a great time to go looking for new money. Metra has a new board chairman, Martin Oberman. He says recent agency scandals, aging infrastructure, and the service failures put him in a tough position.
3 strikes.
Still, Oberman says he intends to make the case for the money Metra needs.
It's fundamentally important to have a thriving business community, to have good public transit. So it's short-sighted not to spend money on that.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Nowadays, you know, the contemporary romance novelist heroine is very strong. You know, she's an engineer, she's a doctor, she's a rocket scientist.
As promised, we did candy and catfish. There was romance. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 23 points today, more than a 10%, closed at 16,130. The NASDAQ up 28 points, about 2/3%, finished at 4,272. The S&P 500 rose 2 points, about a 10%, ended things at 1840. Coca-Cola was the biggest mover in the Dow today, and Coke moved down. Shares in the soft drink maker were off 3.75% after the soda maker said global sales rose less than expected and that sales had fallen here in North America. Tesla Motors share price drove up 2.75% today after a rumor started going around that Apple might be interested in buying the electric car maker. Apple shares up about 1/3% on the day. And also, come on, really? Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for January. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index. And he's considered the father of modern astronomy. Copernicus was born on February 19, 1473. He observed that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but rather that the planets revolved around the sun. However, there is nothing scientific to be said about your observation that you are the center of the universe. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This isn't the first time I've said this, but it does bear some repeating. The American economy is a complicated beast. Pretty much everything that happens in it affects something else, and then that affects something else, and so on and so on. Today's case in point, student loan debt. New figures out from the New York Federal Reserve show U.S. student loan debt rose to almost $1.1 trillion last year. Housing experts are worrying the burden of all that money owed is keeping crucial first-time buyers out of the housing market. But remember, it's never just one thing in this economy. Kate Davidson reports.
Ben Miller crunched the numbers on student debt for the New America Foundation. He says more people are taking on student loans, and when they borrow, they're borrowing more.
So that now you see that the average person who borrowed to take out a bachelor's degree leaves school owing $29,400, and it's about 70% of graduates are taking on that debt.
Those BA earners now have to repay almost $1,000 more per year than their counterparts just 4 years ago. Lawrence Yoon has been crunching numbers, too. He's chief economist at the National Association of Realtors. He says for the last 6 months, fewer than 30% of all home sales were to first-time buyers.
And this is historic lows. Typically, it should be about 40 to 45%. And I believe the key reasoning is that many of the younger households, they are settled with student debt.
Which makes it harder to qualify for a mortgage. But before we wag the finger at student loans, there may be a twin culprit. Rohit Chopra of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says student loan burdens are rising much faster than wages.
Real wages, when adjusted for inflation, have actually been flat for new college graduates for about the past 10 years. So young people have more debt but are earning the same or less income.
That makes student loan debt and low wages together, if not the villains, at least a wrinkle in the housing recovery. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
A moment now for an economic indicator that's gotten a whole bunch of press the past 5 years or so. It's called the Baltic Dry Index. It's a measure of global trade. And as has global trade since the Great Recession, the Baltic Dry has had its ups and downs lately. Downs, most recently. So from London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard on exactly how worrying that ought to be.
An old ship's bell rings out in the lobby of the Baltic Exchange, the world's biggest source of maritime market information. No cause for alarm. These days, the bell is only an ornament. But are we getting an ominous signal from the exchange's best-known product, the Baltic Dry Index?
In theory, it should be a good means of finding out about the world economy. Shipping is absolutely integral to the world economy.
David Osler of the Lloyd's List Maritime Business newspaper, he says the Baltic Dry Index has capsized.
Yes, it's halved since the back end of last year.
And that's the sharpest January fall for 30 years. The index records the cost of this activity, the loading and shipping around the world of dry bulk commodities like iron ore, coal and grain. Key raw materials. And that, says Jeremy Penn, who runs the Baltic Exchange, is why economists pay attention to the index.
The demand for ships to carry those
raw materials can be seen as the first step in the process, if you like, of economic growth and economic activity.
A sharp fall in the index could presage a global slowdown, but not necessarily. Since the world's biggest importers of raw materials have been on holiday.
Chinese New Year is always quiet, and this year, Chinese New Year has come very early. So you have a natural hiatus in the market.
And there's another reason for thinking the big drop in the Baltic Dry Index may not be as menacing as it sounds. The cost of shipping reflects not only the demand for raw materials, but also the supply of ships. Amir Alexander of the Cass Business School has been studying the accuracy of the index as an economic predictor.
If you have too many ships around, then this will result in a drop in the index.
And that's the situation at the moment. Too many ships.
Exactly. There are too many ships.
He says the economic boom that led up to the collapse of Lehman Brothers triggered a shipbuilding frenzy. All those extra ships have now been delivered. The world has 60% more bulk-carrying vessels than it needs. And that leaves the Baltic Index, as an economic indicator, high and dry.
So the movement of the index at this moment could not be a good predictor.
But in a nervous world where economic recovery appears fragile, it seems a safe prediction that economists and investors will keep a wary eye on the Baltic Dry Index. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's the rare author indeed who breaks onto the bestseller list. It's an even rarer author who does it repeatedly in 21 different countries. And I'm not even going to lay odds on an author who gets not one, but two 7 or 8 figure deals from publishers for books. But then there is Sylvia Day, who's done all of the above, and she is with us now. Sylvia, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
For those who perhaps are not familiar with your work, do me a favor and describe your books. What kind of books do you write?
I write what we call contemporary women's fiction, and it's stories about women of various ages who are living in the modern world.
Is romance novels another way to do that, or is that pejorative?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, all of my stories have romance in it. If somebody asked me what I am personally, I would say I'm a romance novelist.
If I use the phrase bodice ripper, does that...
No, actually, that term's been out of date for a very, very long time. Yeah, well, you know, that started back in the 70s because back then, you know, a lot of the romance novels featured women
Fabio on the cover, and
Nowadays, you know, the contemporary romance novelist heroine is very strong. You know, she's an engineer, she's a doctor, she's a rocket scientist, and, you know, having a man in her life is not absolutely necessary. They're fulfilled on their own.
I think I read somewhere that you are writing an average of 3 books a year. Could you tell me how you do that?
Well, I'm a very fast writer, so that's helpful. It really just unfolds like a movie in my head, and I really say that I'm more of a narrator than a creator. I just try to type as fast as I can to keep up.
One of your series has been optioned by Lionsgate, which did Mad Men and Orange is the New Black, for television. And I have a pride of authorship question. You know, sometimes when I talk to authors and I ask them about their feeling after their works have been optioned for movies or television, they say, yeah, you know, whatever, they bought it and they can have it and they can do what they want. What's that like for you when somebody buys, you know, your work and wants to turn it into something else?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate in that in the case of my series, which is the Crossfire series, the producers were fans of the series as readers. They approached Lionsgate and asked Lionsgate to acquire the project for them. And of course, you know, Lionsgate, which is known for doing a lot of book-to-film adaptations and staying very true to the story, was comforting. And we stay in touch quite a bit. I'm a very much part of the process, so I don't feel as if I've been excluded in any way or that I had to just turn over my work and hope for the best. It's definitely not that sort of thing.
You are obviously an author who is in command of her, not just the writing craft, right, because clearly you're selling books, but also the business side of your enterprise. What's the biggest change you think that's been in the past 10 years that you've been in this industry?
Oh, well, I mean, really, it's the shift in power from publishers to authors has been massive. And really, you know, the driving seat now is no longer the sales and marketing department of a publisher who is, you know, on an acquisition meeting and saying, I really don't know how we're going to sell this, to the reader who just can surf on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Kobo and say, boy, that sounds interesting. I'll pick it up. That's why we see these things, you know, these self-publishing books that just explode and publishers are like, what? How did people hear about that? Well, you know, readers are in the driver's seat.
Just because I have you on the line, what is your sense, what are your thoughts on ebooks and the future of the publishing industry as this society changes?
You know what? I love digital books. And I actually started digital first publishing back in 2005. Huh. Of course, you know, now with the novels that I release today, I sell on average 3 ebooks to 1 paperback.
Wow, really?
Yes. Traditional publishing, though, has got a lot of work to do in order to catch up to that.
Did you always want to be a writer?
Always. Yes. I was 12 years old when I decided I was going to be a romance novelist when I grew up.
And here you are.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a dream come true. I absolutely love it. I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Sylvia Day, thanks very much for your time.
Sure, thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that people sometimes say mean things about me on Twitter and on our comments page and in our emails and letters and on cards they send me sometimes too. But anyway, researchers at the University of Manitoba have a new study out that shows people who troll online, that say mean things just for sport, they are often jerks in real life too. So there. I feel better now. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this, what, Tuesday, I guess. Feels like Monday. Today, the Dow off 23 points, more than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 28 points, about 2/3%. The S&P 500 up 2 points, about a 10%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Ariana Tobin and Raghu Manavalan are our digital producers. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.